Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Later this hour, we look back at the creation of the Mashpee National Wildlife Refuge and discuss the ongoing collaboration among local, state, and federal agencies to manage the land and its species. But first, we dive into the State of Cape Waters report with Andrew Gottlieb, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Welcome back.
It's good to see you.
You too. So the State of Cape Cod Waters report takes a look at water quality in some of the Cape's freshwater ponds and saltwater embayments. Is this the first time that we've collected water quality information about these water bodies in one report?
In one report, I think that's true. One of the things we set out to do with this report is, you know, as a regional organization, APCC has a perch that allows us the advantage of looking across the region and sort of stepping back from any one particular water body and say, well, what are some of the common themes and issues that we see that are causing impairment across all of our waters? And so the purpose of the report was to both provide a window into the specific water bodies, and we think we found some ways to provide visually based information that makes it a little bit easier for people to digest what's out there, but also to be able to sort of say, from those individual findings, what are we seeing across the region?
And so let's start with the ponds. If you had to give our freshwater ponds a grade for water quality, what would it be?
It's declining. We found that about 40% of the freshwater ponds for which there was data failed to meet the standards that one would want to characterize a healthy pond. So I'd say 40% of them are failing our measure of environmental health. And the primary reason is excess nutrients. The measure that we use both in the ponds and in the estuaries, sort of an assessment of their health from the perspective of how much nutrients are in there and what does that support in terms of excess plant growth. And we found that much like the marine waters, the ponds are suffering from too much introduction of nutrients from septic systems, fertilizers in the home, and untreated stormwater.
So what was the criteria that you used to determine the quality of the freshwater ponds, and how did you decide which ponds you were going to test?
Well, we used, in the methodologies we used some tried and true environmental measures. So we did not create a new scoring system. We applied scoring systems that are in use in other places because they have a track record. And as I said, they basically are measures of what the nutrient enrichment of the particular ponds are and the clarity of the ponds, which is often a function of plant life and those types of things. And there are a series of threats that are consistent. It's all born out of land use. It's all born out of decisions that we've made about the extent to which we want to manage our wastewater and how we treat the land adjacent to the ponds. Mm-hmm. And the bad news is that we've seen significant reductions in water quality in our ponds. The good news is that there are management alternatives out there that will allow us to turn the tide.
Yeah. And when you're looking at this, you know, the pond, the water quality can vary in the time of year. So when was the testing done? You know, what point in time, and was it done over a period of time? How did that work?
So what we did was we didn't collect any new data for this report. What we did was we took information that existed in the public sphere that had been collected either by towns and other environmental nonprofits, other educational institutions, and ensured that it was collected up to certain quality standards so we could use it. We attempted to use, where we could, 5 years' worth of data, looking backwards. And for the ponds, the primary source of the data is an existing program run in collaboration between University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and Barnstable County, the Ponds and Lakes mm-hmm. sampling program known as PALS. And so we used that existing data set that was out there, applied the scoring system to it, and came up with the results that we came up with. One of the findings that we have on the freshwater side that varies greatly from the marine side is that the data set is thin. Mm-hmm. While we may have 3, 4, 5 years' worth of data, the number of samples for the ponds tends to be fairly limited. It can be just a handful over the course of the summer season, late summer, early fall. And so while we felt that the data was sufficient to make a broad statement about the quality of the ponds, one of our recommendations is that, much like on the marine side, there needs to be a more significant investment in freshwater pond sampling, both so that we get a broader data set across the season, but also more locations so you have a better ability to characterize what's happening in each individual pond.
Were there some ponds where the water quality was good?
There were plenty of ponds. Well, 60% of them met the standard. And, you know, some of them were big ponds, some of them were small ponds. Some of them were what you would consider to be well protected. Some were not so well protected. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things about the lakes is each one is different.
Yeah.
And so it requires a little bit of a deeper dive to figure out what the dynamics are within each individual pond to see what's happening. But, you know, while there was a lot of variability pond to pond, the problems that we found were fairly universal and well distributed.
866-999-4626 is our number if you have a question. We only have Andrew Gottlieb for one segment this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So our drinking water is fine. Our sole source aquifer is not threatened by the nutrient overloading at this point, right? So why should we be concerned about the health of the ponds?
Well, I think the ponds are, for a couple of reasons. The ponds are a window, a surface water window into the underlying quality of our groundwater. And so, you know, the environmental receptors and the environmental function of these ponds is, frankly, a little bit more sensitive to the nutrient enrichment than the human body is. Mm-hmm. And so the surficial water quality we're seeing on the ponds are really a canary in the coal mine if you're looking at it from a human impact perspective. And so what we're seeing is significant impact and alteration of the function of these resources due to human intervention and activity. We can choose to turn a blind eye to it, do nothing about it, and eventually those chickens will come home to roost in terms of impacting the drinking water. The drinking water story is a positive one in that we found the 20 public water supply systems on the Cape provide a very high quality finished water into the distribution systems that meets state and federal water quality standards. That didn't happen by accident. That happened because we've got a long tradition on Cape Cod of recognizing the importance of drinking water and managing to protect it. We've acquired land across the region to protect water supply areas. We've changed zoning to keep hazardous activities away from a public water supply wells. And so the story that the report tells between what happens on the drinking water side, where we've actively managed, and on the estuarine pond freshwater side, where we have not actively managed, it tells a story of what can happen when society decides it's worth investing in something and protects it, and when society decides that something isn't worth investing in, and what we have is highly degraded water bodies across the region as a result.
There are options such as oyster farming or kelp forests to help clean up saltwater areas. Are there similar means to help clean up nutrient overloading in our freshwater ecosystems?
I would say that the options seem a little bit more limited on the freshwater side. You know, and again, it depends a little bit on the what's happening in each individual pond. The easy part is to eliminate the unnecessary discretionary nutrient load. By that I mean lay off the fertilizing. You know, restore natural vegetation that relies on and can be supported adequately by the types of soils that we have. Change your plantings, limit the lawn use, and don't fertilize it. Will go a long way towards having shorefront property owners minimizing their impacts on the ponds. You know, looking more broadly at some of the other techniques and technologies, I think we're going to have to rely on wastewater mitigation. And whether that takes the form of conventional collection and sewering systems or whether progress that's being made potentially in phosphorus-reducing septic systems that can enter into the broader use and solve this problem is something that time will tell.
How do you get buy-in from folks? I'm using less fertilizer. I'm thinking just of the grass. You know, you hear, oh, fertilize four times. I mean, they have these campaigns of how often you need to fertilize, which you really don't, right? I mean, that's not really necessary. You really don't. But people are convinced they do. How do you get buy-in for people to realize how big this issue is?
I think part of the rationale behind the report is to draw a greater spotlight on the consequence. You know, one of the interesting dynamics that we've noticed with this report and with some of the other work that we've done on cyanobacteria monitoring in freshwater ponds, which really isn't even reflected in this report because we looked at data that stopped in 2018. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work we've done on cyano and recognition of the broad scope of that problem has not happened until 2019, is that people really care about their ponds. And I think there is a little bit more motivation, perhaps, out of the gate for communities and the individuals who live on or utilize these ponds to do the things that are necessary. So I think when you tell people we're seeing a decline in water quality and we can draw a clear correlation between the choice that people are making about fertilizing their lawns and what their ability to go and to use the pond or their dog's ability to safely recreate in the pond, I think that those parallels become very clear to people, and I think there'll be a change in behavior.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to saltwater embayments. What grade would you give there?
Two-thirds of our embayments have some portion of them that fail. It doesn't mean the entire embayment fails because a segment of them, but two-thirds of our embayments have significant water quality problems that result in those systems or a portion of those systems failing to meet their ecological function requirements. They don't provide fish habitat. They don't provide recreational opportunity. They are aesthetically unpleasing. And so when two-thirds of the embayments have that problem, you have to say that, and no surprise to anybody who's been paying attention, that our waters are significantly degraded and a majority of them fail to meet the standards and expectations that one would have for healthy ecosystems.
And this was sort of the same criteria used with the ponds, right?
It's a saltwater equivalent of that same metric. And I think that, you know, the work that we've done in this report picks up on a lot of the work that's been done over the last decade through first, the Cape Cod Commission's 208 Water Quality Report, and then some of the additional work that's been done by a number of the towns. Again, when you're looking at it from a town perspective, you say, well, you know, this segment of our estuary is bad and we need to deal with it. When you step back and say, and are able to visually map in a way where red is bad and blue is good, a map that shows two-thirds of the estuaries and every single south-facing estuary in Cape Cod, every single one of them, right, and almost every one of them facing Buzzards Bay, and almost every one of them facing the Atlantic on the east side, all come up red.
Yeah.
That visualization of that is fairly striking.
You know, it's got to be at least 10, maybe even 15 years ago, Buzzards Bay Coalition did this great map where they showed, you know, overlay of where there was eelgrass and where the eelgrass, and it was shocking. I keep saying I wish they would do another one because when that came out, I say at least 15 years ago, I was really surprised to see how, in such a short span of time, how much eelgrass had disappeared.
You know, one of the challenges we face broadly as an environmental community, this notion of shifting baselines. So, you know, what you grow up seeing and what you, if you're a relatively newcomer over the last two decades to Cape Cod, you come and you look at the estuaries and you assume that what you see is the base.
What's always been,
And you lose sight of what has been lost. And one of the things we really want to call attention to through this report is that, you know, the conditions that we have now are unacceptable. They were not always that way, and they don't have to stay that way.
Right. So are there some saltwater areas that historically have had poor water quality and we're seeing an improvement? I mean, you said there's two-thirds that didn't do well, but is that other third just always been okay, or is it
the third that's pretty good, it tends to be the areas on the north side of the Cape that in general have less dense development than the south and west facing sides. and also contribute areas. The land area contributes the nitrogen load to embayments that are structurally very different than what we see on the south side. They're bigger water bodies, much larger openings to the ocean, and much larger tidal range. And so you have the benefits of an increased flushing in these systems, much more open systems, and a lower initial load. You know, we have not yet seen, because the intervention by the towns on wastewater management is really in its early stages across the region, we have not yet seen the benefits that we expect to come from water quality when towns begin to actively and aggressively manage their nutrient loads.
You mentioned the 208 plan, which was created by the Cape Cod Commission to restore embayment water quality on the Cape. We're required by the EPA to address the issue of water quality, and the town of Barnstable just announced an estimate of $1 billion to install sewers throughout the town over the next 30 years. Sewering, obviously, you're not going to sewer the entire Cape. I think people kind of get this image that we want to sewer everything. But is sewering the answer to restoring the water quality in our freshwater ponds and saltwater embayments, or is this a combination of other options?
Ultimately, that choice on the mix of alternatives is going to be made at the individual municipality level. Certainly, sewering through collection and treatment will abate and result in improvement. It will abate the nutrient loading and will result in significant improvement in water quality. We've seen that everywhere that's happened, you do get water quality improvement. There are alternatives, whether it's significant investment in aquaculture, alterations of restoration of natural function of wetland systems, and reopening of artificially narrowed tidal openings to allow for greater flushing. Those are all options that are available. The flexibility afforded in the 208 plan allows individual communities to decide what mix they want. As an organization, APCC is somewhat agnostic, if you will, about what the mix that the community chooses to apply to its particular wastewater problem. Our interest is in making sure the towns move forward with a solution. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter quite as much what the combination of solutions are, as long as they're moving forward with something.
And if people want to see the specific ponds and embayments tested, the report does give much more detailed information.
It does. And so what we've done is, it's largely a web-based report. It can be found at capecodwaters.org.
We'll make it even easier. We'll post it on our website.
That's a great thing. And people can look at both the individual, across the region, and it allows you to zoom into your particular water body of concern, and it provides you a lot more information about who collected the data, what the period of data is. It even allows you to go down and get to the data yourself and play with it if you're inclined to do so. And it also has a lot of good recommendations that are really focused around getting municipalities to act on this issue and the role of the individual constituents who live within the towns to push their municipal officials to do what needs to be done to restore water quality.
All right. Andrew Gottlieb, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.